On behalf of ITRC, welcome to today's training, the Introduction to Hydrocarbons. This class was developed as an offspring product of the 2022 ITRC team on effective application of guidance documents to hydrocarbons. The class is designed to provide a basic overview of hydrocarbon behavior in the subsurface and how to scientifically assess concerns arising from the release of petroleum products into the environment. It will highlight key issues that help identify and manage TPH, LMAFL, and PVI risks together. This course is based on three separate guidance documents developed by ITRC that address the course content in detail. Please make sure to visit the ITRC website and our work to see these guidance documents. I will also be posting the links to the documents after I introduce the trainer. The Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council is a program of the Environmental Research Institute of the States, a 501c3 education and research nonprofit corporation affiliated with the Environmental Council of States. ITRC is a national coalition composed of members from state agencies, federal government, tribal governments, the private sector, academia, and community stakeholders. Our members participate in technical teams which produce tools, resources, and training courses. Please visit the ITRC website if you're interested in becoming a member or need to view the full ITRC disclaimer. If you plan to use ITRC materials, we ask that you review the policy in detail and be sure to credit ITRC. ITRC is partially funded by the U.S. government. ITRC nor the U.S. government warranty the material nor endorse any specific products. I have the pleasure of introducing today's trainers. They have all volunteered time over the years for many ITRC products, including developing and delivering this training. To get us started, we're going to I'm going to turn this over to Tom Fox with the Colorado State and get us introduced to the content. Tom, thanks.
All right, Nicole, I'm looking for my controls.
Yeah, I just need a second. All yours.
Okay, thank you. All right, well, this is my first slide. So basically, with the rapid turnover that's occurring in our technical community and the regulatory community too, ITRC created this webinar to help people adjust into their new job or maybe just a new position. Maybe you just want a refresher. Either way, we're glad you're here. So this training draws from the ITRC guidance that's listed here, and they are the Petroleum Vapor Intrusion, or PVI, the Light Non-Aqueous Phase Liquids, or LNAPL, and Total Petroleum Hydrocarbons, also known as TPH. We'll also be covering and pulling some information from the last document listed here, and that's the effective application of the guidance documents we've listed above. And that all these things can be found on the ITRC website. And if you're interested, CLUIN website has recordings of the various webinars that have been done on each of these topics in the past. So we want you to be aware of this last offering, which includes a guide to navigate the first three documents during the risk assessment. And we encourage everybody to visit ITRC's website to look these up. So where does this training apply? It can be applied very broadly across very different kinds of petroleum sites. Some examples include the typical gas stations. Many of you may work with refineries or pipelines or industrial plants, but sometimes I've even had to use this at landfills and junkyards where petroleum liquids can leak out of various bits of equipment or junk and create an environmental issue. So very complicated sites may need to involve a team of people with various skills. You may need a geologist, for example, maybe a lab chemist to help with some of the chemical analyses and choices and interpretation, and maybe even an engineer to help design or install a remedial system. Our goals today are listed here. First, we're going to give you an overview of some of the key issues that help identify and manage TPH, LNAPL, and PVI risks together. And we found as a team that often people would read one or two of these documents, but really couldn't holistically put everything together. That's the purpose for this class. We also would introduce what's contained in the ITRC petroleum documents and highlight where they overlap today. Third, we're going to be presenting some of the latest science to support best practices for site investigation, including conceptual site model development. We'll also be looking at risk management and regulation development for those of you who are from that sphere of influence. And finally, we're going to be emphasizing the importance of biodegradation and risk management in making your decisions. So, an outline of the course we're going to cover today. First, we're going to go through some of the fundamentals of petroleum hydrocarbons. We're going to look at petroleum chemistry and how our TPH, LNAPL, and PVI all related together and how you can consider them as a unit. Secondly, we're going to be working on building an integrated conceptual site model. What is a CSM? What's its purpose? When are you done? And finally, we're going to be looking at identifying and managing the risks from petroleum hydrocarbons. Looking at these LNAPL risks, we'll be looking at the different types of things that are covered in the LNAPL 3 webinar and the document also in a lot of detail, which we focus on acute, saturation, composition, and aesthetic concerns. And we'll be talking about that more today. So first, let's talk about the fundamentals. To better understand the chemistry of petroleum products, we have to first understand how they're refined from crude oil. And that's depicted in this animation. Here, crude oil is shown on the left, where it is superheated in a boiler and it becomes vapor, excuse me. This vapor is then sent through a distillation column where the vapor turns back into liquid at different temperatures and is drawn off as each of them being a separate refined product. This distillation process separates the crude into hydrocarbon mixtures by weight, atomic weight, which is shown by the number of carbon atoms on the right-hand side of the animation. You can see that the smaller carbon atom compounds are at the top, as I mentioned, and the heavier ones at the bottom. Compounds with only a few carbon atoms are referred to the lighter end compounds like bottled gas and gasoline, are distilled at a lower temperature than the middle distillates like kerosene and diesel. And oils and tars settle to the bottom of the distillation column where they're pulled off and used. Although crude oil can be separated by weight, each of the refined petroleum products is still a complex mixture of thousands of compounds. So this chart shows the typical carbon ranges for several types of refined fuels and oils. You can see that gasoline has a range of somewhere between 4 and 12 carbon atoms, while diesel fuel has a range of anywhere from 8 to 24 carbon atoms. Heavier oils can range up to 20 or over 30 carbon atoms, and crude oil itself can span up to 40 carbon atoms, which isn't depicted here because it's not a refined product. So, what is LNAP? It's a fluid that has a density less than water, hence its term light non-aqueous phase liquids, and it's immiscible in water. It separates, as shown in the picture. LNAPL can be very difficult to assess and recover once it's released to the subsurface. Once it's released to the environment, we refer to that product as LNAPL. And LNAPL contains greater than 99% of the hydrocarbon source mass, and often acts as a long-term source of vapor, groundwater, and soil contamination. We'll be parsing this all out in the next few slides. So now that we've lost the product out of our tank and it's gone into the environment, we call it LNAP. What we'll notice here on the left-hand side, as illustrated in the diagram, is fuel of some type has leaked out of a tank. And it's entered and is going through the soil zone known as the vadose zone, which is not saturated with water. You'll see here that the soil grains in the little blow-up picture in the upper left show that the soil grains are actually coated with a thin film of water, and the LNAPL cannot actually touch the soil, but is actually kind of floating in and around with the water on the surface of the soil. Now, most soils have some element of water to them, even though they're very dry in nature. As the product, due to its mass, moves downward, it'll enter into the capillary zone just above the water table. And here, the LNAPL begins to encounter more groundwater and has more resistance to flow. At this point, the product, if there's enough of it, will begin to move even sideways slightly, and begin to enter into the saturated zone. If there's enough product lost by its own weight and gravity, or what we call head, it will drive into the groundwater water table some distance and could actually displace water from pores between the soil grains. And the bottom three diagrams show these different types of situations where LNAPL can almost fully fill a pore, LNAPL will be only partially filling a pore, or LNAPL may be absent, but it is present as a dissolved plume in the groundwater. On the right-hand side, we're going to talk about LNAPL partitioning. And as I said, greater than 99% of the mass that's lost remains as LNAPL. So only half of 1% goes to air or water or adsorbs to soil surfaces themselves, which is very interesting because most of us as regulators and consultants are after that 0.5%. That's what we tend to be attracted to as a regulatory process. So of that LNAPL, the 99% that's left, if you have a small amount of LNAPL lost or it's fairly thick and viscous, it may just simply reside in the pores of the LNAPL. We call that residual LNAPL. And that is kind of shown in the red bar in the diagram on the right. Of that total LNAPL mass, that 99%, up to 70% could be mobile LNAPL. And we'll talk about what mobile LNAPL is, but basically it's mobile LNAPL is what you typically will see in a monitoring well. And finally, about half of that mobile LNAPL may be recoverable by some type of a remediation system. However, the amount of LNAPL that's recoverable will reduce over time as the LNAPL continues to perhaps spread out a bit and equilibrate with its new environment. So as a result, about anywhere from 30 to 100% of the LNAPL mass can become residual and becomes a difficult situation to deal with. It will vary by the fuel type and the soil type, and also how much degradation is occurring in nature. So we talked a little bit initially about TPH. What is TPH? TPH is just a different way, an indicator to measure LNAPL content in soil, water, and vapor. So ITRC defines TPH as hydrocarbons only, which are compounds made up of hydrogen and carbon, which can be joined into chains, also known as aliphatics, or rings, known as aromatics, for those of you who are familiar with organic chemistry. Once the pH is in the environment, it can migrate from one media to another through partitioning. For example, TPH from a release area could dissolve into a soil pore water and then leach downward into groundwater. Once in groundwater, TPH could volatilize into soil vapor and emanate up through the unsaturated zone, intruding into buildings and indoor air. Therefore, it's really important to understand TPH source and migration pathways when you're selecting an appropriate analytical method and what media you want to sample for your site investigation. I want to emphasize that TPH is just another analytical method. Many of you also focus on BTECs, for example, the aromatic hydrocarbons. TPH is a larger an analytical tool to look at a holistic view of all the petroleum that's there. So TPH versus LNAPL, what's the difference? CSAT is a saturation concentration that indicates the maximum amount of LNAPL that may be present in soil, in pores or fractures. CSAT can vary by the fuel type and the soil type. It's usually determined by TPH analysis. LNAPL may or may not be present in a monitoring well, and we'll discuss LNAPL mobility and other concerns it can create later in this presentation, as I've mentioned. Now that we understand the universe of compounds present in refined products, how do we measure TPH in different environmental media? The answer lies in the analytical method that is selected, and those of you who work in several states may find that some states have no analytical method specified, and some have very specific fractionating methods specified to help identify risk related to that regulatory agency. So I really want to stress this point that the analytical method defines the TPH concentration and provides an approximate concentration of the total hydrocarbons in each media. So what is PVI? PVI is the migration of vapors from petroleum-related contaminants from the surface, subsurface, I should say, into overlying buildings and causes a potential public health concern. Often a key risk driver is, a key risk driver at petroleum-related sites, driving environmental cleanup. It's very strongly influenced by the source type. In other words, gasoline is much more of a PVI issue than diesel or a motor oil. And finally, it differs from chlorinated vapor intrusion in the fact that the petroleum hydrocarbon vapors are very biodegradable. So now Matt is going to talk about how to understand all the risks LNAPL can create.
Yeah, thanks for that, Tom. So yeah, we're going to be talking about a CSM over the next few slides here, and it's really the only tool that we have in our toolbox to really identify the risks that we have from LNAPL and guide how we're going to manage those risks. So let's get into the specifics here. So the CSM has three primary functions. One is to identify potential sources, pathways, receptors. That's what defines risk. And that would be for all current and reasonably anticipated future site conditions. So don't just think about what exists today, but think about what's possible in the future. It's also going to be used to help define your LNAPL concerns, goals, objectives. We'll talk a bit more about those on some future slides. So that's getting to the risk management side of things. And it's going to be that tool to help support decision making on site, whether it's regards to how you're going to screen the site, whether or not you need to do some further data collection, or how are you going to manage those risks. So the CSM, it's going to be text. Usually, that would be supported with a number of figures or diagrams, and it's constantly updated as you collect data. So you start with a CSM and then you work on refining that through an iterative process. So here's an example of what a figure might look like that would be found in a CSM, where here you've got a LNAPL release that came from an above ground storage tank, AST here. They've got some surficial LNAPL residing on land surface that potentially represents a risk for dermal contact, getting it on your skin, someone potentially eating the soil or inhaling the vapors. Okay, so that LNAPL that so on the surface, all likelihood, it probably seeped into the unsaturated zone or vadose zone and worked its way down to the water table, as shown here. So that LNAPL that's in the vadose zone may represent a risk to groundwater from a leaching process. So you need to understand that. If it's worked its way to groundwater, well, what is re representing the risk then? Maybe it's a risk to a drinking water well that's located down gradient, somebody ingesting that water, or eventually this plume of hydrocarbons making its way to a surface water body where it would discharge and represent a risk to not only the critters and the fish that might reside in such an environment, but then also anybody who might be exposed swimming or contact, direct contact, again through dermal or inhalation or ingestion of that water. So you see it all pictured here. All of those potential pathways need to be taken into account. You need to identify where your sources are and where are those receptors as well. We also have just pictured on the slide, in case you're wondering, some pie charts, and they're used to depict where is that hydrocarbon mass, where's the most of the mass? And if we look at the one that's pictured in black here, if we're looking at the LNAPL that's in the vadose zone, most of that hydrocarbon mass is going to be in that LNAPL or that liquid immiscible phase. Very little will be in the air phase, relatively speaking, or absorbed to soil or groundwater. If you get outside of where that LNAPL or that residual LNAPL might be in that pore space, well, then you're going to see that hydrocarbon mass somehow distributed amongst the absorbed the vapor and the what's in the pore water. And then if you're in groundwater, it would be some mixture of, or mass distributed amongst the air in the water. So those were what those pie charts represent. But just being mindful that I would argue 95, 98, 99% of the source mass that's going to contain the hydrocarbons in this scenario will be in that LNAPL. All right. So if we look at this next slide here, it is a checklist that ITRC has developed to help guide someone through the development of a CSM if you're not used to developing one. And so it's a step-by-step procedure there, and it includes some references to where you can find out more information about these aspects of the CSM development in the LNAPL guidance and the PVI guidance and the TPH guidance. So it's a very handy checklist for working through and developing a CSM. As you develop a CSM, you have to keep in mind that not all CSMs are the same. And so that is depicted here in this figure on the right. If you look at the x-axis here, a higher risk site, and that may be defined by the constituents of concern or more toxic. Maybe it's you've got sensitive receptors or ecological habitats nearby. Maybe your reputational risks or community issues are heightened at that location. Well, that's a site where you're going to tend to try and invest more in your CSM to get it right. And then if we look on the y-axis here, as your site complexity goes up and you're dealing with more complex sites, think about it, let's say a fractured rock type sites, maybe real difficult to figure out where is that LNAPL or those constituents of concern located and how are they moving through that environment to receptor. So that's going to take more investment of resources to have a CSM that you feel confident in. All right. So when are you done? Well, you've got to be able to walk away with understanding, have you identified all of the sources, pathways, receptors for current and future scenarios? Do you have enough information to bound uncertainty? So you're going to collect data, but because it's Mother Nature, you're not going to have all of the information you may need to know how concentrations vary over time or space, for example. But you have to have enough information to be able to say, well, we know with pretty good confidence that it can't exceed this concentration or it's not going to be in this location. And then lastly, you have to have sufficient information to be able to identify those LNAPL concerns, goals, and objectives. And we'll talk a bit more about that. So obviously, if you're in a low risk site, like an urban gas station where you don't have any drinking water wells, maybe you might be okay with having a CSM that's not as complete as it would be at a site like we talked about in the last slide, where you have higher risks associated. So just bear that in mind again. All right, and I'm going to end it there and pass it back to Tom here to lead you through identifying managing risk from petroleum hydrocarbons.
All right, so we're going to start with this. This is a general overview of a lot of the things that Matt just finished talking about. And basically, Matt's gone through the initial CSM, and obviously, with a conceptual site model, there's going to be more information that you gather over time that you'll add and refine your CSM. And we're going to be talking about the site management, defining our goals and objectives, and how to implement remediation or perhaps only mitigation and institutional controls if it can't be cleaned up. So there are four different types of LNAPL concerns. We have a risk and safety concern, which is very acute, such as explosion, fire type concern. We will have a saturation concern, which deals with migrating LNAPL, where the risk is expanding and potentially getting closer to other receptors that we hadn't initially considered. We'll also be looking at composition and saturation concerns, which are not only where we've got some mobile LNAPL, but also the residual LNAPL that is bleeding off and creating either groundwater, soil, or vapor concerns. And finally, a smaller portion, but no less important, are factors such as sheens on water bodies and other aesthetics that might be present, such as stains and odors in soils that might even interfere with some of its geotechnical properties for use in buildings, for example. So we're going to be looking at each of these four types as we move on through our presentation. Let's get some terminology straight. So apart from acute emergency risks, which are addressed immediately, ITRC identifies three remedial concerns for LNAPL. Saturation is derived from the amount and behavior of LNAPL in the formation. We'll talk about this more in the next slide. Compositional concerns are derived from the chemistry of the LNAPL, such as those associated with vapors, groundwater, and soil contact. And most of us are concerned a lot with compositional concerns, especially as the site ages. And finally, as I mentioned, these other aesthetic concerns like seeps, sheens, staining, and other things. The first LNAPL 3 guidance suggested a decision process to identify these concerns, establish remedial goals, the objectives of each technology step to address the goal, and then selecting the technology that might best be applied. First, LNAPL concerns are verified using threshold metrics detailed in the guidance. Some perceived concerns may be eliminated. Then remedial goals are established, which translate into an LNAPL concern, into a measurable LNAPL outcome. Each concern may have its own goal, or sometimes multiple concerns may share a common goal, and we'll find some technologies can address more than one concern at a time. Finally, remedial objectives describe how the goals will be achieved. Remedial objectives are used to identify the remedial technologies that will accomplish your remediation goal. However, regulations on how to identify and address these concerns vary by state, so it's really best to work together with your local regulatory agency to come up with the appropriate process that you're going to employ at your site. So the concerns that are generated by LNAPL will differ based on the scenario, the way it presents itself. LNAPL typically exists under three different conditions as presented on the slide, and these conditions generally relate to the severity or age of the release. So site one at the top represents a new release. LNAPL saturations and gradients are very high, and the LNAPL footprint is expanding, or the LNAPL is migrating. The immediate concern is a saturation concern because the LNAPL area can expand to impact more receptors. LNAPL migration should be mitigated immediately. However, it's also important to understand compositional concerns may be present, and the mitigation steps that may go into this may be such things as barrier walls and other things that we'll talk about a little later. The important thing with migrating LNAPL is you'll see it appear in wells that previously have not had LNAPL. However, that also has its own level of tricks and so on of the trade that we'll talk about. In the middle site, at most sites, LNAPL was observed in wells where the LNAPL footprint is stable. And LNAPL migration typically stabilizes somewhere between about, well, less than 2 to 5 years from the release. Often you may not even see migration at all because there's not enough lost. So we call this mobile LNAPL in the middle diagram. It can move in and out of the well screen based upon things such as water level changes, but the LNAPL is not migrating. It may be recoverable, but the primary concerns are to evaluate things related to composition, related to your soil, vapor, and dissolved concentrations. LNAPL recovery may be a component of the remedy. It may even be a regulatory requirement in your state, but composition will drive the health and safety risks. At site number three on the bottom, LNAPL is not visible in wells. The LNAPL is trapped in the pore space, and residual LNAPL is present. the residual LNAPA will continue to be a long-term source of compositional concerns as it leaches off or vaporizes. Sites 1 and 2 look the same. In other words, LNAPA is visible in the well, but sites 2 and 3 behave the same with respect to their associated risk profiles. So let's look at a little bit to try to parse out saturation versus composition goals. And this is where it becomes really important to try to decide whether it is worth the cost benefit to go after a small amount of LNAPA in the well. So the composition of LNAPA is a main risk driver on most petroleum sites. Let's focus on how we might be able to change the composition of the LNAPA. Why is composition change very important? Well, research has shown that reduction in saturation, in other words, the LNAPA mass that's present, has very little effect on the dissolved concentration unless almost all the LNAPA from the source zone is removed. It's much more efficient and effective to target your constituents of concern, like BTECs, that are a small fraction of the total LNAPA. For example, benzene is just one of many hydrocarbons in gasoline, but in many cases, it's the main component driving risk. So on this graph, I want you to look here at A, the phase change remedial technology, which we'll talk about a little bit later, to reduce the benzene concentration in the gasoline, will move our benzene concentration from A to C and focus on the benzene, which is our main concern. It's going to be much more effective in reducing risk than trying to recover some, but you'll never get all, of the bulk gasoline. So in other words, as I move from A to B, I am removing the LNAPA itself. If I move from A to C, I'm trying to address the benzene content of the LNAPA and change its composition. So Steve will now introduce the first of seven key points we want you to understand about LNAPA, and then we'll take a short break.
All right, thank you, Tom. Yeah, I'm going to start with the idea of what does it mean when you have LNAPA in a well? And if you have LNAPA in the well, it does not mean that your NAPA body is migrating. In fact, most NAPA bodies stabilize relatively quickly. And in most of our petroleum sites, the NAPA body is lightly stable. What you see here, and I should say one of the major driving forces for LNAPA migration is the LNAPA gradient. LNAPA gradients might start in an initial release pretty steep and drive migration, but they dissipate rather quickly. What you see here is a cross-section of a NAPA release. On the bottom are photographs of a sand tank experiment. On the left, it's and the NAPA has dyed red. And on the left, this is shortly after the NAPA body or the NAPA reaches the water table. And on the right is sometime after the release has dissipated and the NAPA body has expanded. Above it is just some illustrations that representing what's below. And in the bottom, the white dashed line represents the NAPA gradient. In the illustrations, the red line is the NAPA gradient. You can see the NAPA gradient is typically steeper than the groundwater gradient, but and you can see as that NAPA body expands, that gradient dissipates. And another key factor that stabilizes the NAPA body is that after that release is abated, and as that NAPA spread, capillary retention retains NAPA in the soil matrix. And so that is the losses of NAPA to residual saturation. That NAPA gets trapped in the soil pores as that NAPA migrates laterally, as well as vertically with fluctuating water tables. So LNAPA plumes are basically self-limiting in a finite release. Basically, as that once that release is abated or stopped, that NAPA expansion, that gradient drives the migration. As that NAPA expands, that gradient decreases, reducing that driving force, and then also that residual saturation factor. As that NAPA body expands, more and more NAPA is trapped as residual, and it further reduces that potential mobility. So in summary, a finite release means a finite extent. Another factor that stabilizes naval bodies are losses. And below is a quote that was intended for the dissolve phase, but this also accounts for LNAPA bodies as well. And those losses could be hydraulic recovery. It could be enhanced biodegradation or biodegradation. But when the fluxes of the loss mechanisms match the NAPL flux of migration, your NAPL body is going to stabilize. So what you see on this graphic is natural source zone depletion, which Chris will cover later, and that talks about biodegradation, volatilization, and dissolution of the NAPL body itself. And, you know, historically, LNAPL bodies were once thought to continue to migrate indefinitely, similar to how groundwater flows to an aquifer. But years of field observations has showed that these NAPL bodies and better understanding the physics and the NAPL science behind it, LNAPL bodies stabilize relatively quickly. Initially, you have high sat initially after the release, you have high saturations, you have large gradients, and that's what drives the NAPL migrations. You can have NAPL that migrates down gradient faster than that groundwater flow. You also get radial spreading, as NAPL can migrate up gradient and cross gradient because of that higher hydraulic or LNAPL gradient. And then after that release is abated, right, that petroleum hydrocarbon mass is finite. It is limited. So that gradient dissipates. NAPL is trapped in pore spaces that further reduces its ability to spread and its the migration potential. And what we found is most NAPL bodies tend to stabilize within a short period of time, you know, less than 5 years. So how do we confirm that stability? We recommend using multiple lines of evidence. And what you see here are multiple lines of evidence that are presented in the new ASTM guidance, moving sites to closure. And in that document, I won't go through these, but there's just some examples here. And in that document, they recommend that, hey, if you know your release was abated 5 years ago, then one line of evidence might be sufficient to demonstrate stability. If you don't know the date of your when the release was abated, or if it's less than 5 years, two lines of evidence might be sufficient to demonstrate some stability. But of course, the number of lines of evidence used should be reflective of the distance to your receptors and the sensitivity of your receptors. And additionally, your data set should be spatially and temporally enough to understand the variability of your site conditions. And I think with that brings us to our first question period.
Yeah, thanks, Steve. Thanks, trainer. So again, a reminder that here in our Zoom webinar, we have the Q&A pod that you can submit questions to get to our trainers so we can run through. Give everybody a minute to find and use the Q&A pod as needed. We will have an opportunity to ask questions at the end of the training as well through the Q&A pod. And a reminder that you can submit questions at any time. We do have additional support in the background. So let's ask the question we have here, and then we'll keep moving along with the training. But trainers, not sure, maybe there's a couple of you that want to chime in on this one, but what portion of crude oil is LNAPL? Or is LNAPL only related to refined petroleum products like gasoline?
So yeah, I'll take that, Nicole. No, crude oil is not necessarily a refined product. However, because it isn't oil, it will behave similarly to these refined products. There are several pipeline releases here in the country and elsewhere where the loss of the crude oil from the pipeline is being addressed using some of the same methods we talk about here to assess risk, and as we get into it, you know, cleanup technologies. So I think that can best answer that question, unless there's another question to follow.
Yeah, I'll just add on to Tom's comment or response there. Just LNAPL is light non-aqueous phase liquid. So that means it's this immiscible liquid. And that is all. So it can take on forms like crude oil can be a non-aqueous phase liquid, gasoline in its pure form, diesel, heating oil, all those are light non-aqueous phase liquids or non-aqueous phase liquids. The light part is just that these tend to be less dense than water, these liquids, and so they tend to reside towards the top of a water table and don't sink to the bottom.
Put emphasis there. Trainers, I'm going to put out the next question and see if we have anybody that is able to kind of jump on this. But with natural gas here, can you expand on its composition in the refinery process since lots are switching to natural gas? Or if we have a ITRC guidance document that we want to point to.
Yeah, well, natural gas in and of itself is dominantly methane with some small amounts of impurities. And of course, your local utility will add mercaptan to it, which is that typical natural gas smell that many of us detect if there is a leak. We don't really address natural gas in this process too much because obviously it volatilizes so quickly and is not often remaining in the subsurface where we often deal with a lot of the risks that devolve from LNAP.
Great clarification. Thanks, Tom.
Yeah, it wouldn't be an LNAP, all right. So it's a gas, so it wouldn't be a liquid, an immiscible phase liquid like LNAP.
Keep the questions coming, audience. The Q&A pod will stay open, but I'm going to keep us moving to go to key message two and
All right.
set Steve back up.
Thank you very much. Yeah, I'm going to start with LNAPL thickness has been used to evaluate NAPL sites and make remedial decisions. But what is gauge NAPL thickness really telling us? Not much, unfortunately, other than the fact that LNAPL is present in the formation. So, and one reason why we don't know what it's not telling us much is that LNAPL thickness in a well has different volumes in the formation depending on the soil type. So the graphic that you see here in the middle that says gasoline, represents a monitoring well with 3 feet of LNAPL in it. The chart on the left, it presents the different NAPL saturation profiles in the formation using the vertical equilibrium model for different soil types. And also the associated LNAPL specific volume, which is the volume of NAPL per square foot of the aerial footprint of the NAPL body. So historically, LNAPL was thought to float on the water table and occupy 100% of the pore space. And that is represented by that pink rectangle, the pancake model is what it's called. What we found is that the LNAPL shares the pore space with water, and the distribution of NAPL, water, and air depends on the soil and NAPL types, and includes the capillary properties, interfacial tension, and density play into how that saturation profile looks. The vertical equilibrium model derived LNAPL saturation profile. It looks like a short fin, shark fin, sorry, shark fin, and it's often just referred to as a shark fin model. The coarser the grain size, the higher the LNAPL saturation. You can see the gravel is the black line. And the higher the specific volume for that same measured NAPL thickness. So you can see the gravel has a greater specific volume than the silt. The pancake model overpredicts volume, and the overprediction gets more and more significant as the grain size becomes smaller. And so, if you were just looking at thicknesses and you showed up and put pumps in, you decided to do some recovery in two wells that had 3 feet of NAPL, One's in gravel, one's in silt. The response is going to be significantly different. The recovery rate, the total volume that you recover. So thickness doesn't really inform you what's happening in the formation. And I'm about to show you a quick movie that shows illustrates a diesel plume in a gravelly sand aquifer that had there's a significant water table fluctuation, and this site has been gauged by approximately 50 wells over a number of years. The blue gauge on the right is the average groundwater elevation, and then the contours are the napple thicknesses. Red is about 4 feet, pink purple approaches 0 feet, and the groundwater level fluctuates about 8 feet. And really, what the takeaway here is, you can see that the El Napo footprint changes with the water table elevation. As the water table goes up, the napple thicknesses decrease and the footprint decreases. And as the water table falls, the thicknesses increase and the footprint increases. But there's no real change in the extent of the footprint. The napple body is stable. The fluctuation you see as far as the extent and the thicknesses is all related to that water table. And you can even see how the thicknesses, there's times when there's no napple at the site. Woohoo, it's clean. But as Tom talked to earlier, that residual napple could play a big role at the site and your concerns. So we'll dive a little bit. Oops, I thought I was changing the slide. Dive a little bit into why that is happening. So what you see on these five panels, on the top portion, these are saturation profiles. Blue is water, red is napple. So the napple saturation goes from 0 to 1 right to left, and the water saturation goes 0 to 1 left to right. And below that is a typical hydrograph. The red represents the napple thickness, the blue is the groundwater elevation. So in panel A, you can see that the napple has been recently released to the water table. There's a shark fin profile, a high saturation of the napple. In panel B, the water table has fallen. And you can see that what happens as that napple falls with the water table, it leaves behind a strip of residual El Napo. And you can and then when we move over to panel C, that water table rises and more napple is trapped. It's occluded in the pore spaces below the water table. And when you look at the hydrograph in the first few steps, that napple thickness is decreasing. It's still in the well. And C, it's in the well, but it's less than what you see in A and D, and that's because more napple is trapped in the soil pores. And if the water table continues to rise, like in panel D, the full mobile napple footprint saturation profile can get submerged as residual and occluded in the pore space. And you'll show up to a well and there'll be no, the water table will be high and the napple thickness, there'll be no napple in the well. But as soon as that water table falls, that napple is released from the below the water table and can accumulate in a well again. So those are the dynamics that's happening when you see fluctuating water tables in relationship to the napple saturation profile. And again, right, with napple thickness might seem like a good indicator, but there's a lot of other complications that can occur. So what we've been talking about right now is unconfined El Napo, and that's where the bulk of the napple exists at or near the water table. When the water table falls, the napple thickness increases. When the water table rises, that napple thickness decreases, just as we saw in the previous slides. But there's other conditions that can happen. If you look at the graphic in the middle bottom row, this is what we call perch napple. So napple is released, it drains through the vadose zone, and it accumulates on a fine-grained soil. It cannot penetrate down to the water table. If you install the well, El Napo will fill that well like a waterfall. It'll depress the water and will fill until you reach a hydrostatic equilibrium. And the air napple interface will equilibrate with the air napple that's in the formation. And what you get is this exaggerated napple thickness. And as the water table falls in this case, the napple thickness increases to match that hydrostatic pressure. If you look to the left, it's called confined LNAPL. It's similar, but flipped over. So basically, you have mobile NAPL that is below the water table, that is and below a confining layer, below a fine-grained soil that is below the water table. That NAPL enters the well and fills it up until it reaches hydrostatic equilibrium. And what happens is the NAPL is because of the density differential, the air NAPL interface is above the potentiometric surface, and the NAPL water interface will equilibrate with the where the NAPL is in the formation. Again, you get exaggerated thicknesses. In this case, as that water table rises, the NAPL thickness will increase because of the increased pressure on the NAPL. And then on the right is fractured rock or preferential pathways, and you can have multiple conditions. You can have the NAPL can behave perched or confined depending on where that water table is in relation to how that NAPL exists in the formation. So remember, LNAPL in a monitoring well means LNAPL is present in the formation and LNAPL is mobile. It does not mean it's recoverable or migrating. You need to collect additional information to understand that stability or recoverability. So we're going to shift to identifying residual NAPL. And this is key. We kind of touched on it a couple of times, right? The residual NAPL behaves the same way as a mobile NAPL in the sense of concerns, dissolve phase and vapor phase. And as Matt mentioned, the majority of our mass is stored in that LNAPL source. And that LNAPL source drives the vapor and dissolve phase plumes. So understanding where that NAPL source is, including residual LNAPL, is important for targeting your remediation as well as identifying those potential concerns. It's particularly important for screening for PVI, petroleum vapor intrusion, because hydrocarbon vapors concentrations are much greater and will tend to migrate farther above an LNAPL source than a dissolve phase source. Therefore, it's important to identify residual NAPL. However, residual NAPL sources are often mistaken for dissolve phase sources, even though they represent composition risks more similar to a mobile NAPL that accumulates in wells. So residual NAPL, it can be difficult to distinguish. It's hiding in plain sight, but it's critical because that LNAPL sources, for example, could contain as much as 500 times more constituent mass benzene than the dissolve phase sources. So you just told me this was tricky. How do we figure this out? And fortunately, ITRC published in the PVI guidance a list of indicators. These are general indicators. The criteria here was based largely on assuming the LNAPL is gasoline. These criteria thus should be applied with caution if you're assessing other fuels. The LNAPL indicators are defined based on groundwater and soil concentrations as well as proximity to the known source area. And the values listed in this table, they're not absolutes or shouldn't even be used in isolation. The idea is to use multiple lines of evidence, right? This is to give you an idea of where things might be. We've got some additional lines of evidence. These weren't published in the PVI document, but these are some other things to look at in soil gas to give you a hint. If you see oxygen and carbon dioxide at these levels, oxygen, carbon dioxide, and methane at these levels, that's an indication of biodegradation of the LNAPL source. So if you see the oxygen, CO2, and methane, depleted oxygen and elevated carbon dioxide and methane could be an indicator that there's biodegradation of an LNAPL in the formation. And also at the aliphatics. Aliphatics have low solubility, so we don't expect them in a dissolve phase. So when you see aliphatics above in the soil gas, indicator that you're above a residual LNAPL source. And finally, I'm going to leave you in this slide deck for when you download it and take it home. Here's a number of references that are available or point to references in the ITRC LNAPL 3 guidance document that provide LNAPL characterization tools to help you with your CSM. All these CSM elements provide important information to understand and predict LMAP behavior, and they're valuable lines of evidence to support management strategies and remedial decisions. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Chris to talk about biodegradation.
Great. Thank you, Steve. So here we're moving on to our key message number four, and that is that biodegradation helps LNAPL bodies and groundwater plumes stabilize and or shrink. So I think Steve covered the fact that field evidence shows that LNAPL bodies stabilize quickly. We've known for a long time that biodegradation is a key actor in the dissolve phase. We've got a lot of documentation that speaks to monitored natural attenuation, but it's been relatively recently that there's been work that's determined that there's a significant amount of biodegradation that occurs in the LNAPL body itself. So we'll spend a few minutes talking about that because, as both Tom and Steve noted, 99% of our mass is, you know, of a fuel spill is in the LNAPL body itself. So that's really important to focus on. It might be helpful to think of an LNAPL body like a glacier. Similar to a glacier, LNAPL plume is a dynamic body. There's forces that can add to or subtract from its mass. In the case of LNAPL, we're talking about volatilization, dissolution, and primarily biodegradation. Of course, there can also be active recovery. Also worth noting that similar to a glacier, an LNAPL body can have a stable footprint, but we still experience internal mobility. So Steve spent a lot of time talking about what happens when water levels rise and fall, and we see that that imparts a change to what we visualize in the LNAPL body. So we've identified this as mobile LNAPL. So focusing on biodegradation, aerobic biodegradation has long been recognized as a contribution to improving groundwater quality. But with regards to LNAPL, this occurs in an anaerobic environment. So there's specific microbial populations that adapt to those conditions. And we can now quantify those, which is what we're going to speak about a little bit later in natural source zone depletion. The rates of natural source zone depletion vary as a function of the LNAPL type and temperature. But you know, we can also recognize through changes in the composition of LNAPL that these things are occurring. Just shown here, we've got at the far right a microscopic photo of some of these methanogenic microbial populations that act to reduce the LNAPL body itself. And again, as we show at the little cartoons on the left, this in situ biological destruction of the LNAPL produces methane, CH4, as well as CO2. So we'll talk about that in more detail when we get into the flux component and how we measure natural source zone depletion. So here's one of the diagrams that comes from the ITRC's LNAPL 3 document. It has a great deal of information in detail about the natural source zone depletion processes and how they can be measured. Simply put, these methanogenic microbial populations produce methane, shown at the little equation on the bottom and on the just above the LNAPL body in the box. So we see CO2 and CH4 off-gassing. So that's through degassing and ebullition off of the LNAPL body itself. And as they move up through the soil profile and reach the upper near surface oxygenated soil, that methane is oxidized to CO2, which is a exothermic reaction. So we can measure a heat profile there. So these are, again, multiple lines of evidence to indicate what's occurring. We can also measure CO2 in the shallow soil gas. And once we subtract for CO2 that respires through plant action, we can look at that footprint and equate it back to the parent hydrocarbon through a stoichiometric relationship, which allows us to quantify the destruction of an LNAPL body in place. So these tools have been developed over time. They're continuing to be refined. We see the rates of natural resource zone depletion estimate sites change from, you know, as the methodology has improved. But there's plenty of evidence to indicate that this is in fact what's occurring. So this slide shows a comparison of natural source zone depletion rates and recovery rates from three types of remediation systems. The box and whisker chart plots actual remediation system recovery rates from 43 sites that demonstrate a range of several thousand to upwards of 100,000 liters per hectare per year. So we have to be careful about our metrics here, which essentially like a three order of magnitude range of what we might expect from these 43 active recovery systems. And then in the gray box, the rectangle that goes across this graph, it represents the 90th percentile of the range of destruction for natural source zone depletion. So no active remediation taking place here. And that averages out at about 170 gallons per acre per year. So our metrics aren't exactly the same, but we've compared them here. And it's a very useful comparison because the natural source zone depletion values are every bit as good as, and in some cases, better than these active engineered systems. So it's important to recognize that, to be able to measure that. It's going to help us make decisions about how effective our remediation systems are and when it might be time to employ the treatment train methodology to move from system A to system B, or to shut down a system and rely solely upon natural source zone depletion as our remedy. Is that possible? I mean, the regulatory programs all are a little bit different in this regard. But what this slide tells us is that we really need to consider natural source zone depletion as an element of our LNAPL site conceptual models. It may be that natural source zone depletion by itself is allowable, is an effective remedy for a site with residual NAPL. But at a minimum, we can use natural source zone depletion to verify the extent of the underlying LNAPL body footprint. We're not going to get a methane signature unless we're overlying LNAPL. We can use natural source zone depletion metrics to determine when it's time to change from, again, system A to system B, perhaps when a system has reached it's the effective endpoint of its operational life. And we can also kind of get a handle on, you know, what a realistic time frame might be to bring a site into compliance, whether it's risk-based or, you know, removal to some mass destruction value. So again, keep this natural source zone depletion concept in mind when you're dealing with your LNAPL sites. Make sure that's part of your conceptual site model. So now we're going to switch gears a little bit and talk about the in situ destruction of petroleum hydrocarbons. And Diane's going to talk about this in greater detail. But what I'm going to introduce to you is we're now talking back to total petroleum hydrocarbons. So these are bulk TPH values that we measure in dissolve phase. And the destruction of petroleum occurs in a stepwise fashion. And one of the intermediates that's generated as petroleum hydrocarbons degrade naturally in the dissolve phase is we see these polar metabolites. So there's the box at the bottom right shows N-hexane and at the top line, and below that, two polar metabolites that form through the systematic breakdown of N-hexane. And what you'll notice is that these compounds have oxygen in their molecular structure, and they are three orders of magnitude greater solubility than the parent. So that results in something that is significantly has a greater propensity to move in the groundwater system. So the polar metabolites will outpace the parent hydrocarbon if we're looking at dissolved plume. Now, you may not recognize this if you're analyzing for bulk TPH. The polar metabolite's going to look just like the parent in a bulk TPH analysis, the value you get. So the onus is on us to kind of figure out when we're dealing with polar metabolites, what information can we bring? And there are th primarily three different opportunities to recognize that we have polar metabolites in our bulk TPH analysis. And that tells us that we have an active biodegradation taking place of these hydrocarbons. The first is just looking at the chromatogram. We see this metabolite hump. It might be the known as the UCM, the unresolved complex mixture. But that is comprised primarily of polar metabolites. The second is to run our TPH analysis with silica gel cleanup and without silica gel cleanup. And the silica gel will strip out the polars. And so if we compare the analysis with and without, the difference is polar metabolites. So in this particular case that's shown at, circled on the right, we ran TPH diesel without silica gel cleanup and got a result of 2,900 micrograms per liter. We ran it with silica gel cleanup and got a non-detect result, stating that that initial value was comprised 100% of polar metabolites, evidence of active biodegradation. And then the last line of evidence here, what's shown on the bottom left, is as I noted, due to the difference in solubility, you'll see that the polars will outcompete or move farther down gradient in the dissolve phase than will just the BTECs or the TPH compounds themselves. And then that's compared to the LNAPL, which by definition is non-aqueous, therefore it's insoluble. And so it again stabilizes quickly, doesn't really move with groundwater flow. So we see this hierarchy of more soluble components being carried farther down gradient in our systems as they age and intrinsic degradation takes over. And we're switching gears again now. This is our last slide in this little section. It's a pretty complicated slide, but what it shows is the difference in gas phase properties. So now we're looking above at concentrations of species in vapor phase above a hypothetical LNAPL body, which exists at the bottom of this graph on the x-axis. So in the NAPL air interface, we can measure very close to the NAPL body, very high concentrations of contaminant. That's not unexpected. So we see benzene, we see methane, CH4, we see CO2, all very high. And as we move upward through the soil profile, we reach this aerobic anaerobic transition zone where atmospheric oxygen is driving down into the system and it reacts, as we noted before, oxidizing the methane to CO2. So we see the methane drop right off, the benzene drop right off. And this has major implications for petroleum vapor intrusion, which Matt's going to speak about. But again, the presence of oxygen, which promotes rapid aerobic biodegradation, is a limiting factor for vapor intrusion of petroleum compounds. And I think that covers this section.
Great, thanks for that, Chris. So, we're gonna switch gears a little bit and talk more specifically about petroleum vapor intrusion here and how it's associated primarily with LNAPL sources. And it really comes into play when we start looking at how we screen sites for petroleum vapor intrusion. So, if we've got LNAPL present in the subsurface and that's our source, then as Chris was talking about, you can have these microbes working at the hydrocarbon mass that volatilizes off of that LNAPL source and biodegrading it in that process, consuming oxygen that they need for aerobic biodegradation. Well, once all the oxygen is consumed, then things get anaerobic and they look for alternative electron acceptors like sulfate, nitrogen, nitrate, iron, and so forth. So when processes become anaerobic, they slow down. And so we're very conscious then of Where is this interface between anaerobic biodegradation and aerobic biodegradation in the vadose zone between a source of LNAPL and a building foundation? And provided there's sufficient separation between the two for this interface to develop, then the potential for vapor intrusion becomes relatively negligible because what's happening there is the rates of aerobic biodegradation exceed the rates at which these hydrocarbon vapors are migrating vertically upward by diffusion through the vadose zone. So that's why this sharp interface develops, and that was amenable to developing screening distances. So we have for LNAPL sources from evaluation of lots of empirical soil gas data that we've collected over the years that were put into a big database, information at what distance above a LNAPL source or even a dissolved phase source, as you see on the right, do conditions in the vadose zone become negligible for vapor intrusion to occur. So looking at petroleum hydrocarbons, it's when did those concentrations fall off before risk-based screening levels for vapor intrusion? So for LNAPL sites, we found that distance was around 15 feet for petroleum UST sites and 18 feet for what we're calling petroleum industrial sites. So these would be, oh, your refineries, your tank farms, your pipeline type sites, where you'd get more LNAPL mass in the subsurface, more hydrocarbon mass, so longer screening distances. Now, if you compare on the right side, we've got dissolved phase source scenario where now that anaerobic interface is developing right, really pretty much in the capillary zone, right near the water table. So in that case there, the potential for vapor intrusion really becomes negligible unless that water table is coming in contact with a building foundation, which rarely ever occurs in case of a slab on grade foundation. But for a basement, that's possible. And so you don't want that to happen. And so we landed on a vertical screening distance of 5 feet. And that's to account for uncertainty in knowing at one particular time where is that top of the water table going to be and that potential for contaminated groundwater getting into someone's basement. Okay, so that's how that screening distance was primarily defined for dissolved phase sources. All right. On this next slide, we're looking at now the screening distances defined in the lateral direction. So, what ITRC landed on is now source type doesn't matter because we're defining a lateral screening distance, what they call the lateral inclusion zone, of 30 feet from the edge of a residual LNAPL source in the vadose zone or a dissolved phase source in groundwater. Okay, so any building that's within that 30 feet would have to be assessed for the potential for vapor intrusion, or in that case, you would apply the vertical screening distances. Okay, now, it's all based on the fact that when we put in monitoring wells or boreholes, we tend to put them in on tens of feet centers. So we don't exactly know where that edge of a residual phase LNAPL might be or where the dissolved phase plume for, let's say, a compound like benzene might extend. So that's why we landed 30 feet as kind of a buffer distance. But if you can define that lateral edge with certainty, either in the vadose zone or the groundwater, then you can apply screening distances of 5 feet from the dissolved phase source laterally, or 15 feet in the case of the residual phase source in the unsaturated zone. Because biodegradation should occur similar rates laterally as they do vertically. So it's all about a buffer distance and uncertainty. Now, there are cases here where you cannot apply the screening distances, and that's where you might have preferential pathways for vapors migrating through the subsurface. And that might be through a utility conduit, such as a sewer, or maybe it's through a fracture in a bedrock scenario. Now, for it to serve as a preferential pathway, it must connect the vapor source to the building. If it doesn't, it's not a preferential pathway that would serve as what we call a precluding factor or not prevent the application of site screening. We also have in this category is precluding factors for site screening are certain fuel types, and these are old historic leaded fuels that may, well, will have contained lead scavengers. And these are compounds that were added to leaded gasoline to help prevent lead buildup in car engines. We didn't have any information in the database at the time the screening distances were derived to say anything about how these lead scavengers might migrate vertically upward from a source at the water table. Or for ethanol in gasoline, where it was more than 10% by volume. So thinking here, even like E85 or higher ethanol content blends that we haven't seen really in use in the marketplace because we don't know anything about these fuel types. We can't really say much about how you might screen out. Now, there has been some work done since the PVI guidance was developed that would suggest that these screening distances are okay for the lead scavengers and for these higher ethanol content fuels. The third one on this list is an advancing expanding plume, and that's simply, hey, how you can't screen a site or a building, I should say a building out that's located down gradient of your plume. If it's still advancing, it may get underneath that building. And then lastly, certain soil types. So these are soil types that, again, we didn't have any vapor, any data in the database to say anything about whether or not that screening distances could vary if it was a very arid soil. And this is one that doesn't have even the moisture to allow for biodegradation, something you'd see maybe in the desert regions of Arizona, or soils with very high organic matter where some of the oxygen that gets into the vadose zone is being consumed in the oxidation of that organic matter. And these would be very unusual soil types like peat, because we had a lot of information on clays and so forth, and really didn't see screening distances vary depending on whether it was a sand or clay. So, unique environments, don't expect these to be precluding factors at many sites. And the last one on this list is EPA did a modeling study where they found any building that had both the width and the length of the foundation being greater than 66 feet on each side. So it has to be at least 66 feet on each side, would also result in longer screening distances because you're preventing, in that case, oxygen from getting into the subsurface. We haven't seen that from any empirical studies where supports that model, but that's what the model came up with. So EPA includes that one as well. All right, so if you fail the screening distances, the next you have to think about what media you're going to sample next. And it all depends on how close is that source to the building foundation. For scenario one, and that's a scenario where your contaminant source is separated from the building foundation, you want to try to focus on soil gas because, again, what you're going to see in the soil gas is those concentrations changing by several orders of magnitude as you get farther and farther vertically upward from that source of contamination. If that contaminant source is very close to the building, well, that's where you're probably going to want to look at collecting indoor air measurements, or as part of that subslab soil gas measurements. Subslab could also be part of scenario one, but we really want to be collect data that's away from a building, if at all possible. We'll talk about that on the next couple slides. Then lastly, there's this other scenario where you might have future construction where you don't have that building to go measure indoor air. And in that case there, you're probably winding up measuring either groundwater concentrations or soil gas concentrations and feeding that into a vapor model like BioVapor or Johnson and Ettinger to predict concentrations that someone might be exposed to in indoor air. Okay, so why do I say stay away from the building? Because if you get inside the building, what happens? If you look on the left side here, this figure, you see the frequency of detections being, oh, close to 90% or more for these BTEX compounds being found in indoor air, and it's coming from carpets and paints and wall coverings and so forth. So other sources in indoor air, and not necessarily from the source that's in the subsurface. So it makes trying to figure out where are those vapors coming from and is vapor intrusion really occurring very challenging. And then if we look at the concentrations that you might find in indoor air, look on the right side here, this figure, typical concentrations for compounds like benzene are like an order of magnitude above a 10 to the minus 6 risk level. So again, you go inside, you measure this stuff, and now someone's being exposed at a level that's above the risk level for vapor intrusion, and it's a very difficult conversation to be had. Lastly, I'll just mention that here listed on this slide are references within the Petroleum Vapor Intrusion guidance on where you can find out more information on how to actually sample for vapor intrusion, and depending on what media you're sampling for and the appropriate analytical methods. And I will point out that ITRC has recently come out with some new vapor intrusion guidance. They're calling that the VI toolkit. So that toolkit contains lots of great information and the latest best practice since this PVI publication in 2014. So please consult that if you want to know more about sampling methods and analysis. And I'll leave it with that and then turn it. Oh, got a Q&A over to Nicole.
Yeah, thanks, Matt. And thanks to the audience. You've been asking some great questions, and if you have not had a chance to take a look at those, we are answering them publicly so you all can get the benefit of seeing the question and the responses from the trainers. We are caught up in our Q&A pod. I'll remind you, we will have another chance to get some questions at the end here. I will encourage you to go in and look at the Q&A list and responses, especially around the MZSD conversation. There was a great series of questions and answers to give you some more information. But with that, and just to keep us on time right now, I'm going to queue up Diana to keep us moving. Please keep using the Q&A pod throughout this presentation. And again, we'll keep up with the questions as we can and try to get you as much information as possible in this time we have. But Diana is going to keep us going, and we are going to switch gears to TPH and key message number 6.
Great. Thanks, Nicole. So up till now, we've done a lot of talking about how to look for and how to detect LNAPL in the subsurface. But as Tom mentioned way up front at the beginning, TPH or petroleum is going to be present potentially in all different phases, not just as an LNAPL, but in dissolved and sorbed phases as well. So we're going to transition a little bit now into what do we do with the petroleum that is not LNAPL, that is dissolved or sorbed phase. And the first thing that everybody needs to keep in mind is we use the word total petroleum hydrocarbons or TPH. But when you're dealing with analytical data, you have to remember that the TPH is not necessarily total, doesn't necessarily mean it's all from petroleum, and it's also not necessarily all hydrocarbons. And I know that sounds incredibly contradictory, but we're going to go through and kind of explain what that means. So, looking for TPH in the environment, you're going to use, there's a number of analytical methods that can be used to do that. And the trick here is that TPH, when you use any of the analytical methods, is a highly variable result. It's going to be defined by the analytical method used to measure it. So, for instance, if you're using a total TPH method, you're going to actually be grabbing every organic compound that's present in that sample. And that's what we mean by it's not necessarily all petroleum. Most of the bulk TPH analyses are pulling literally every organic compound out of the sample. And so depending on what analysis, your results could vary dramatically. But the bulk TPH analyses do give us kind of an idea of what the total hydrocarbons are in a mixture. And it is like you'll hear me use the term bulk TPH because it really is giving you one number to accommodate to estimate everything that's there. But these analyses can be useful. They do help provide us some information on what's present. And you'll notice that on the right side of the slide, I have some chromatographs, and you will learn that chromatograms can be really important when you're interpreting your TPH data because that can actually tell you a little bit more about what you're dealing with. So, the key thing to remember when you're looking at analyzing your samples, and this is either soil or groundwater or air, any of the above, for TPH, is that the results can differ wildly depending upon what analytical method you use. So this particular slide is showing you what we got from as results by using four different TPH analytical methods. And you can see that none of the what we were analyzing here is actually petroleum, but some level of TPH was reported in the results from all of these different methods, and they do vary significantly. So keep that in mind, especially as you're looking at sites over time and you may be looking at new data versus older data. You really need to check your methods. You really need to check your labs because your results may not necessarily track consistently across laboratories and across different methods over, especially over time. So with all of that, what are we dealing with here? Well, like Chris mentioned earlier, when you get your TPH result, it could very well not all be petroleum hydrocarbons. And what these two chromatograms are showing you is that before doing any form of cleanup, and I'll talk a little bit about what silica gel cleanup is here in a minute, you can end up with a fairly large detection of something that really is essentially not hydrocarbons. In this particular instance, the presence of this hump, if you look at your chromatograms and you see a hump like this, that is usually indicative of petroleum metabolites. And the silica gel cleanup will clean those out because they're not hydrocarbons. And what in this particular example you're left with is an actual hydrocarbon result of non-detect because everything that was being reported in that sample was petroleum metabolites. The same thing can be true if you have commingled plumes. For instance, you can see if you have, say, chlorinated solvents commingled with your hydrocarbons, your chromatograph will show you spikes that are not hydrocarbon range, that are indicative of other compounds. So when you're dealing with TPH data, it is helpful to look at the chromatograms because that can actually help you distinguish whether or not you're really dealing with hydrocarbons or whether or not you've got something else going on. So how do you pick a method? Well, different methods actually have different levels of usefulness or different goals. So if you're doing a bulk TPH method, so this is your 8015, sometimes 8260. If you're looking in Texas, it's like your Texas 1005 method. These are really useful for when you're getting to trying to get an understanding of just the overall extent of what you have present. The advantages is that these are tend to be inexpensive analyses, so you can run a lot of them. The cons are that it could very well overpredict your hydrocarbons because you'll be picking up everything that's present. And because you're just getting one big number, they aren't super useful in risk assessment. There are ways you can use them by assuming surrogates of the more toxic compounds, but that's going to likely overestimate your risk. So bulk TPH data isn't super useful from a risk assessment standpoint. Your other option is to fractionate it. Now, there are specific methods that actually use silica gel in the method to break out the different fractions of petroleum. So they typically are separating your aromatics from your aliphatics, and they're breaking it down into specific chain lengths of carbon chain lengths for the different size compounds. These will help you get a better understanding of your conceptual site model because it actually helps you understand more about what weight of hydrocarbons you're dealing with in what samples and what locations. And they also this is also going to help you better define your fate and transport because different fractions are degrade and different fractions are move at different rates and speeds. The downside is fractionation methods are expensive. However, one other plus side to this is that because the fractionation method actually uses silica gel in the process, it automatically cleans up your sample and removes all of the non-hydrocarbons. So when you get your data from a fractionation method, you are confident that you are looking strictly at the hydrocarbons and not at other things. The final one I have on this list is your use of silica gel cleanup. And this is what you're going to mostly pair with your bulk TPH methods. And this is useful for getting rid of your non-hydrocarbons so you can actually see what you're really dealing with from a hydrocarbon standpoint. This will remove your petroleum, your polar metabolites. It'll also remove any conflicting compounds. Case in point, I had a project many, many years ago where it was a former soap manufacturer and there was a lot of tallow in the soil. And somebody ran bulk TPH and they were getting really high TPH numbers. But when we actually did a silica gel cleanup and we looked at the chromatograms, we realized that what we were picking up was beef tallow, not actual petroleum. So the silica gel cleanup can be super useful in helping you get a better understanding of your CSM, help you get a better understanding of what your fate and transport might be, and looking at potential risk from the hydrocarbons. The downside is depending upon your regulatory agency, they have different regulatory agencies have different thoughts and methods and opinions on how you should be dealing with your polar metabolites. If you are in an agency that requires you to include the polar metabolites in your overall risk calculations, then your silica gel cleanup is removing those from the compound. So you'll have to have, you may need both a pro silica gel and a without silica gel result to really do your meet the requirements of your regulatory agency. So once again, in summary, all of what we have is with these different TPH methods is that we can use them in different ways. They have different utility. They will provide us information on the hydrocarbons, the size of compounds that we're dealing with, whether we're dealing with heavy or light or intermediate size, hydrocarbons, how they're distributed. And the results are going to vary by the analytical method you used. And what's not on this slide is they will also vary potentially by laboratory because different laboratories calibrate using different calibration compounds. So be cautious in using TPH data from different sources and from different time periods. And always keep in mind that when you look at your TPH data, it's not necessarily total, it's not necessarily all from petroleum, and it's not necessarily all hydrocarbons. So, moving on into more of the risk side of things, one of the things to keep in mind is the composition of the fuel and the composition of the hydrocarbons in your environment. Both are they matter. They're going to make change. They're going to change your potential risk profile. What is that? What does that mean? Well, as an example here, I've got on the screen three different hydrocarbons that all showed a bulk TPH result. So this was an 80/15 result of 15,000 milligrams per kilogram. First one is gasoline, then diesel, and the last one is crude. But if you look at the chromatograms here, you can see that there would potentially be a different risk outcome with each one of these. For instance, the gasoline, all of your spikes are at the far left, which is on the lighter end of the spectrum. That's going to lead you to suspect that you're going to have a lot more potential for an inhalation risk. If you look at the diesel, all of your spikes are kind of in the middle. So you're a little bit less likely to be heavily into that inhalation phase or range, but you're much more likely to have your ingestion, your dermal contact, and all of those are going to be the dominant pathways there. If you look at the crude, you're kind of everywhere. When you have the potential to actually have a risk from multiple pathways here. So The point here overall being that different petroleum compounds can lead you to different risk results and or different risk concerns, I guess is a better way of putting it. So keep that in mind when you are looking at your TPH data. Not every TPH result means is gonna is equal to each other in a risk standpoint or from a risk standpoint. So another thing to keep in mind when you're dealing with TPH is all of the biodegradation characteristics that Chris talked about earlier. Those mean that doing a risk assessment with TPH is different than doing a risk assessment from an individual compound. Because as TPH degrades over distance and over time, the ratio of compounds within that mixture will change. So if you're up near the source area, you might be dealing with a lot of L-NAPL. You'll be dealing with a lot more less, or your TPH will be probably the less degraded variety because you're much more in the source area. You've got a lot more L-NAPL. As you move further down gradient, you're going to lose that L-NAPL and you're going to start getting more of the longer lasting hydrocarbons and the more mobile hydrocarbons, and you're going to start running into metabolites. When you get all the way down gradient, you could very well be largely in metabolites and a lot less in petroleum. So, from a risk assessment standpoint, what does this mean? Whereas with an individual compound, you could take samples from the source area and sort of model and predict their concentrations down gradient. It's a lot harder to do that with TPH. You really kind of need data and need samples from all of the different media and all of the different locations. And similarly, time. If you have old data that may not actually be reflecting what's going on or what you're dealing with from a current risk standpoint, or even especially not a future risk standpoint. So you need to make sure that your data are of an appropriate time frame and are collected from the right locations so that you are actually looking at risk that is appropriate for those locations and times. The next thing to think about from a risk assessment standpoint is the toxicity side of things. If you recall, risk is basically made up of exposure times toxicity. And so, how do you evaluate toxicity from a mixture of compounds when normally what we're dealing with is individual compounds? Well, there's a few different ways you can go about this. Historically, we've kind of ignored the TPH results and just focused on individual compounds. So you would calculate your risk from your BTECs and your PAHs and not really worry about the rest. But depending upon how old your site is, some of those compounds may be degraded away and you could be missing the potential risk if you ignore the TPH. So that approach can be useful, but it can also miss a lot of your potential risk. Another option is there are toxicity values available for whole products. So there is an RFD out there, a reference dose out there for like particular jet fuels, for mineral oil, etc. That seems like it would be ideal. However, those toxicity values are generally calculated based on research on fresh product, which may not be what you have at your site. And the ratios of the different compounds within the toxicity studies may not at all reflect what you're actually dealing with at your site. So whole product risk assessment can be useful on fresh spills if you're using a compound that was the same as the standard that was used in the toxicity data. But when you start looking at all of the potential variations there, it's going to be only under very specific circumstances where you can look at whole product toxicities. So what do we do? Well, what we do is we look at fractions. So this is where your fractionation methods come into play. Your fractionation methods are breaking down the aromatics from the aliphatics, and they're breaking them into specific lengths of or sizes of compounds. We can look at those categories and pick surrogate compounds for each one of those categories and give them toxicity values associated with that. And that right now is really kind of considering considered the state of the art in the world of TPH risk assessment. It's about the best you're going to be able to do, and it's going to get you probably the most specific and accurate results that you can get. From an ecological standpoint, you do have the option of running individual toxicity studies, but those can be costly and there are challenges associated with that. So what you'll find is most of your risk work is going to be done using this fractionation method. One thing to keep in mind, different agencies use different fractions and different toxicity values associated with those fractions. So when you're picking your analytical method and when you're picking your screening levels or your toxicity values, you need to be very certain that you are using the appropriate set for your regulatory agency, because regulatory agencies can vary by orders of magnitude in terms of these toxicity values. They've each calculated them individually. So make sure that you are consulting your agency and that you're using the right set of numbers. The interesting thing about TPH is we often talk about risk assessment in terms of tiers, and TPH is particularly well suited for a tiered approach to risk assessment. Tier one is typically your screening level risk assessment. A lot of times you may only have, at the very beginning of a project, you may only have bulk TPH data. You can find screening levels for bulk TPH that just tend to be overly conservative. And you can use those screening levels to look at your bulk TPH data. And if everything's below, then you can be pretty confident that you're outside of a potential risk concern. But more often than not, you'll have some TPH data that's going to exceed one of those bulk TPH screening levels, and you want to move on to a tier two risk assessment, which is much more site specific. This is where you're going to want to collect your fractionation data and use more specific screening levels and give you a much more accurate result for your site. So because of the different types of data that are available for TPH and the way we tend to organize our investigations, a tiered approach like this is particularly effective in this regard. So kind of to sum all of this up, keep in mind that TPH is a complex mixture. It is not like working with the individual compounds that we typically do from a risk standpoint. Because it's a mixture and it has specific fate and transport properties, this is going to affect how you're going to assess your risk. It's going to affect how you're going to collect your data to assess your risk. And it really needs to be kept in mind as you're planning on this portion of your site assessment. Different types of TPH data are useful to different parts or different in different ways. You can use your bulk TPH data and your indicator compounds, which by that I mean your BTECs and your PAHs, at a screening level. But if you don't screen everything out there, then you're going to probably need fractionation data to really look at things from a more site-specific assessment. But the key here is that it's really important to understand your data, your CSM, and your regulatory framework, because all of these things can really make significant differences in the level of risk that you end up assessing at the end of the day. So, with that, I'm going to move on to risk management. I think Tom is taking on this section.
Nicole gave me control. So risk management. We're moving to the end here, people. So let's talk a little bit about risk management. How do you address it? What are you going to do about the risk that you perceive? So once you have a good conceptual site model, you can do a couple different things. One thing you can do is you can collect additional data to make your CSM more robust and help you fine-tune your decision. Maybe you feel that you have a data gap somewhere or you just need some other piece of information. You have to be careful that you're not collecting additional data and putting off the decision you're trying to make. So just be aware of that. It's a almost human condition, I think, to delay. The second thing you can do is to choose a remedial action, which might include mitigation or some type of engineering control. So the three middle boxes here kind of all go together. And then your third choice might be to place institutional controls on the site, such as deed restrictions or some other way to restrict access and exposure to the contamination that might end up in place. And some states do allow institutional controls to be put in place on various facilities. But very often you're going to find that some type of remedial action is going to be necessary before institutional controls are considered. So these risks are generate into remedial goals. So you take your LNAPL concern that I spoke about before, and here are the four concerns that the LNAPL 3 document breaks out, and I strongly encourage you to take a look at that document on ITRC's website, because most of what I'm speaking from here concerns that document. So you take your LNAPL concern, And we talked about risk, migration, mobile or residual LNAPL, and then other concerns. And each of those concerns generates an LNAPL goal that you're going to consider. And the goal basically points you into the type of remedial action that you're going to be using. So if you have a saturation goal, for example, that means that you have a large mass of LNAPL, residual or otherwise, that you're trying to address. In this situation, you might have too much and you've actually got migration occurring. So the objective for this saturation goal example is that you have some type of mass control or recovery technology that you're going to employ. The example and the goal are to stop LNAPL migration by containing the LNAPL or reduce the LNAPL saturation by removing it from the subsurface if that's possible. Your second goal might be compositional. In this case, we're trying to create a phase change, either to volatilize or some other way degrade the contamination that's in place based upon benzene, toluene, and other BTEX compounds that most of us deal with. So, an example here is to change the characteristics by some sort of phase change. Most commonly, these things are things like air sparge and SVE. And finally, you may have an aesthetic goal, which basically you're just trying to eliminate the cause that somebody has a concern about it, whether it's visual or an odor or something like that. It may be a sheen into the river. So, one example would be to stop the LNAPL from seeping into a river, which sounds fairly simple, but actually can be very complicated. So, the LNAPL3 document runs through a variety of different remedies. There are 21 remedial technologies that are outlined in the LNAPL3 document. And the document also has five different appendices that helps you get through LNAPL remediation and reducing concerns at a petroleum release. So, once you have identified your concerns and you've selected your remedial goals, these documents can help you determine which management options you want to consider. So, just shown here are several different bubbles. Remedial technologies in the LNAPL3 document are grouped into three groups. There are phase change technologies, which are shown at the top. Mass recovery technologies are on the left, and mass control technologies are on the right. And within each circle, you see different types of remedial technologies listed. You can see that some of the technologies fit into more than one group. They overlap the circles. For example, in the center of all three circles, you'll see multi-phase extraction or MPE, which can address all three goals. It'll remove the LNAPL, stop it from migrating, and also create a phase change condition where you're removing the chemicals that are of concern. And that's why this technology is frequently used. let's see, moving on. One important thing about choosing your technology is as you get into it, you need to think about how you're going to measure your performance and progress in getting the site cleaned up. So performance metrics and endpoints are used to establish how a remediation technology performs and hopefully when you can stop using. You should develop these, as I mentioned, before you get started. And what you're trying to look for are conditions that are going to change as you implement the remedy. So you're going to choose your metrics and Appendix A in the LNAPL document, which lists all the different technologies, has good suggestions of what types of metrics you could use for each technology. You have to consider the changes that will occur as you implement the cleanup. And it may be important to collect some baseline data up front before you initiate or do anything like enhanced biodegradation or maybe in situ chemical oxidation. How else would you know that you're doing anything good? And pilot testing is typically done in order to make sure that, when you fully design your system, it'll have the effects that you want. Each remedial technology also requires agreement among stakeholders on when the remedy will no longer be beneficial. And metrics can be used to define that endpoint. And that's the point where you have maximum remediation that a given technology can achieve. So, and this is either allows you then to decide to transition to a different technology or maybe just optimize the one you've got. And finally, you might even use your technology to actually get to your closure goal and make your regulator happy. So there's a lot of new ASTM guidance that's out now. There's one called E3488. It's moving sites to closure. This has been out now for about a year, and it's compiled some examples of performance metrics into it. And we're going to talk about those in the next couple of slides. So ASTM subdivides performance metrics based upon those that are system related and those that are subsurface related. They're subdivided then into saturation concerns and compositional concerns, which are the little C's and S's you see after each of these bullet points. And so ASTM has adopted some of what ITRC has proposed. So here are some good examples. All these and more can be found in the guidance document. But let's take a look at the top system-related metrics on the left. So, for example, for TPH COC concentrations for influent and effluent, those are concentration-based metrics that you're going to be looking at. And for fluid recovery rates, for example, you're going to be looking at the LNAP, the vapor or water ratios, and these are things that are saturation-based. In other words, the mass of the LNAP itself. Similarly, for the subsurface side on the right, you might want to look at groundwater, soil, or soil gas concentrations over time or over an area. And these are concentration or composition-based metrics. Whereas whether LNAP is present and in what thickness in wells, which is the third bullet down on the right-hand side, is more of a saturation metric that you can use. Note that all of these focus on monitoring the changes you expect to occur during implementation of your remedial technology or the strategy you're implementing. What's really important to consider, and again, ITRC goes through this, is your metrics must be SMART. This is a nice little mnemonic, and it stands for specific, measurable. In other words, you have to come up with a number. It's attainable. You can collect the data. The metric is going to be realistic or relevant to what you're doing. And it's also going to be time bound. In other words, you have to set a schedule for the improvement. So, using metrics like these, here are some examples of transition thresholds from the ASTM guidance. These are also subdivided into saturation concerns and composition concerns with the C's and S's as I've just gone through. And let's look at a few. So, the first bullet defines an endpoint for LNAP recovery. If the LNAP transmissivity is below the threshold range of 0.1 to 0.8 square feet per day, then further significant LNAP recovery is unlikely. You're just wasting money and time unless you transition to another method or system to address the concerns at the site. The second bullet from the top is a decline curve analysis. If recovery stabilizes at a low rate with no further improvement, you should think about changing your strategy. If you need to consider whether to either reconfigure the existing technology to work better or optimize it, you may need to transition to a different technology or take a different strategy, like maybe institutional control, or you may even be able to move to actual site closure with it under a further action letter. So you need to carefully choose realistic endpoints for your remediation technology, and I want to emphasize that. These metrics and the endpoints are by the technology. The endpoint for the technology may not get to your remediation goal, which is closure, but that's what you use a series of treatment trains for to reach that goal. So once you've reached the predetermined endpoint for each technology, further efforts are basically deemed ineffective and you need to move on to a different strategy. Okay, to wrap this up very quickly. In our training summary for TPH, some of the key messages that are here. The characterization of TPH, LNAP, and PVI requires a very integrated approach, and the conceptual site model is constantly updated and forms the basis for all your risk assessment and risk management decisions. TPH is defined by analysis. It characterizes the nature and extent of the petroleum, whether biodegradation is occurring. And it also looks at the type of TPH analysis, depends on the investigation goals. For LNAP, we've talked about this pretty much at length, but to remind you, LNAP is a source of long-term vapor absorbed in dissolved gases. LNAPL can be present in soil pores, even if it's not visible in wells, and LNAPL bodies typically stabilize very quickly. Mobile LNAPL in wells does not mean that the LNAPL body is migrating or that it's even recoverable. LNAPL thickness in wells is affected by the soil type, water table fluctuations, the hydrologic condition. Biodegradation processes deplete LNAPL source mass and helps to stabilize the LNAPL body and reduce migration over time, which is one reason that the LNAPL body will stabilize. And finally, remedial technology selection is based on the LNAPL concerns that we've covered: saturation, composition, and/or aesthetic issues. For PVI, the important thing to take away is that biodegradation in the vadozone limits the potential for PVI and serves as the basis for lateral and vertical screening distances that are outlined by both EPA and ITRC. And PVI risks are mainly associated with the lighter end LNAPLs, such as gasoline, not so much with diesel or motor oil. They don't contain a lot of volatile compounds to begin with. And finally, proper identification of residual LNAPL sources is really critical because these can lead to long-term concerns. Site characterization should focus on the vadozone, given the high likelihood of encountering gasoline-related COCs in indoor air at above risk-based screening levels in the vadozone, closer to buildings. And with that, I believe, Nicole, it's back to you.
Thanks, Tom. Thank you to all the trainers in our audience today. We've had a great discussion here. The introduction to hydrocarbons. So, as a reminder, we do have several resources available on the ITRC website. Your fastest way to get to them is to go to itrcweb.org. And at the top of the page, you'll see our guidance and docs drop-down menu, and you can search for any of these terms on that guidance and documents page. We did highlight that in 2026, in January, we published a brand new vapor intrusion toolkit, which does provide some updates to the PVI guidance. And so we encourage you to head over there and take a look. I have dropped the link for the certificate of completion into the chat. You should be able to access that now. And scroll all the way down to the bottom, you'll see feedback form. And as a reminder, if you want that certificate of completion to be emailed to you, you do need to check that box in the lower right hand. We really appreciate everybody joining us today. You will get an email when this training has been archived and available for on-demand listening, so you can come back for additional information or share it with colleagues that were not able to join us today. We will do another offering live of this course again in the fall in October. So please take a look at upcoming training opportunities by ITRC. Again, itrcweb.org. And this time you would go to the training dropdown at the top menu, and find our upcoming courses. We are not able to use the raised hand function. So, anybody that has a hand raised, please go ahead and communicate with us in the Q&A pod. We will stay here for a minute just to make sure that we don't have any additional questions. But this is the end of the training. Again, thanks so much to our trainers for joining us once again. This was a fantastic class, as always. And again, thanks for those that are submitting into the Q&A pod. We'll stay open for a little bit just to try to make sure we can get through some of the questions. If we do not get to your question and the webinar ends before that, please feel free to email your questions into itrcweb@itrc. I'm sorry, I put that into the chat. It is itrc@itrcweb.org is our email address. You're welcome to send us questions and follow-ups, and we'll get them to our trainers.